Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Junto Presents. The premier podcast for genre fiction and audio drama. We bring you an original presentation performed by talented Hollywood actors utilizing top-notch audio production techniques. Join us at Franklin Manor, home to the Junto, a gentleman's club in the classic style where adventurers, mystics, and other unique individuals gather to socialize and conduct their private business. We offer you a glimpse at the strange and wonderful things to be found there. So please, sit back, relax, and enjoy the Junto Presents.
Hello, and welcome to this week's Transpondence from the Archives of Franklin Manor. My name is David Parkin.
And I'm Robert Gibbs. Tonight we're broadcasting from the Grand Hall here at Franklin Manor, made especially festive by one of our famous Cannon trees.
A blue spruce grown in an undisclosed Canadian tree farm by Clavis Cannon, brother of our full-time groundskeeper Agamemnon. Each year, Clavis personally delivers the tree via horse-drawn sleigh.
He's very particular about that, too. He claims that trucks and exhaust drain the tree of its holiday magic. So every December, he makes the chilly 3-day journey himself, which we very much appreciate.
And it's cold out there. He was pretty grumpy when he arrived yesterday.
We warmed him up. He's better now.
Did you give him a blanket?
Yes.
And some cocoa?
Yes.
Did you put his feet in a bucket of warm water?
You know, if you know a better way to warm up a frozen Grecian, then I'm all ears.
As wonderful as the tree is, it's the ornaments that get the most attention around here.
Yes. Dave and I have the honor and privilege of working with Allison Harris, the curator of the museum here at Franklin Manor, to convert one new piece of the club's history into an ornament for the tree each year.
We have an actual pair of Ben Franklin's bifocals, a key from Franz Liszt's piano, a lens from Edwin Hubble's telescope. We even have a brooch owned by Clara Barton herself, and they're all fashioned with the utmost care.
It really is beautiful. I especially appreciate Charles Dickens' inkwell. Real proud of that one.
As you may know, in our last episode, we featured one of the two stories Dickens wrote expanding on his famous work.
With ink from that very well.
You know it.
That was a high five. We just high-fived.
Yes, we did. Tonight, the Junto presents part two in the series, The Ghosts of Christmas Eve.
Death has a remarkably clarifying effect. I had never credited stories of an afterlife. In my estimation, the monuments and institutions men left behind were of more lasting value and credit to one's name than anything to do with kindness or morality. I have always appreciated a well-maintained ledger, one that is neat and precise, in which the numbers balance and all debts are paid. Careful attention to such considerations helped me become wealthy and powerful in my life. And so, I faced my demise, sure in the knowledge that while nothing but oblivion awaited me, I had secured the only meaningful sort of legacy a man can make for himself. I was soon to discover that on all accounts, I was badly mistaken. There are rules that govern death, though, as with the rules of life, they are often confusing and rarely explained clearly. Upon my expiration, I grasped the continued existence of the soul beyond the mortal coil is, in fact, a reality, and that in my case, it was unlikely to be pleasant. Walking away from me, I saw a terrible tall spirit shrouded from head to toe in a black robe. Before me stood three large, forbidding men dressed as laborers, holding in their arms a great and fearsome chain. This, I was informed by one of the personages, was forged out of a lifetime of my sins for the which I had never repented. When the work of outfitting me with my chain was complete, the man who had spoken before commanded me to go out into the world and wander ceaselessly. This was my punishment for a life of selfishness. As they departed, I was overtaken by a bone-deep need to walk that could not be ignored. And so I did, for years. I wandered between familiar pathways and spectral reaches unknown. I would make my way through offices and public spaces into the vast ironworks where sinners' chains are constructed link by link. Apart from the living, who went about their affairs heedless of my presence, I was surrounded by the souls of other spirits who had been consigned to my same fate. By and large, they were unpleasant company. There was no clear consensus as to what was even happening to us. Most said we were in hell, which was easy enough to believe, though others maintained that ours was only a transitional state, a purgatory, from which escape was possible once sufficient atonement had been made. Such a one was Drebble, a former business colleague who had died some years earlier. He made a habit of running up to living persons in the streets and offering them assistance. This, he presumably, did for the benefit of some watching unseen authority who might feel inclined to reconsider his fate. He certainly didn't do it for those he approached, as they were entirely unaware of his presence. I was resolved to avoid such humiliations. If this was my lot, so be it. I would find other ways to fill my time at attention. Often that turned out to be observing Scrooge. When first I met Ebenezer Scrooge, he was still young, working as a clerk in the offices of that daft old fool Fezziwig. Scrooge was quiet and serious. He also had the best mind for figures I had ever encountered, excepting my own. His books were immaculate, nice and exact, down to the last farthing. I took note of him immediately, and thought to myself, here is one with promise. Which is not to say he was without flaw. Beneath the exterior reserve, I detected within Scrooge hints of sentimentality and a too generous nature, tendencies of which he would need to be broken if he was ever to realize his full potential. Removing Scrooge from Fezziwig's orbit was my first order of business. Though the young man proved to be damnably loyal, it was only when I appealed to his duty to provide for the family he planned to start with his betrothed, Belle, that I was able to convince him to become a partner in the house of Marley and Scrooge. Of course, Belle was a different problem. After a few minutes with her, Scrooge's cool demeanor would thaw, and he'd transform into a smiling idiot. Happily, the remedy could not have been more simple. I had only to ensure that Scrooge spent as little time in Belle's presence as possible. Our days were long, but his commitment never flagged, and in time the intensity of his engagement with his work rivaled his engagement with Belle. When she left, she told Scrooge that it was because he had come to love money more than her, and in that moment he maintained a steely composure which suggested it might be true. But that night, as I passed his closed office door, I could hear his pained sobs. The searing fires Scrooge passed through on that night helped to forge the man he would become. The next morning, he arrived to our offices early, and from that day forward never made any indication of heartache or romantic interest of any kind, at least none that I could detect. His sister, Fan, was the last remaining object of his self-defeating affections. The connection between them was powerful, and what attempts I made to weaken it were met with, let us say, formidable resistance. Once, Scrooge used his rapidly growing influence in the city to secure favorable terms on lodgings for Fan and her new husband. I remarked that his sibling, who had done nothing to deserve his intervention other than having the good fortune to be related to him, was rather taking advantage of him. A cloud of anger passed over Scrooge's face, and for a moment I feared he might do me physical harm. The rest of the day's business was conducted with a tension-filled silence hanging between us, and he departed at closing without another word. The subject of Fan never did come up in conversation between us again, with one notable exception. Never had I seen a man more stricken with grief than Scrooge on the day Fan passed away in childbirth. But this was the last time in my life I would ever see such a naked display of love for another human being from Scrooge. Not even Fan's bereaved husband and young nephew were able to break through the barrier he erected around his heart. And on the occasions they would visit, The memory of his departed sister only seemed to render him more unpleasant and out of sorts. Scrooge grew sour, vindictive, and quick to anger when confronted with anything other than numbers. Once untethered from those he had loved, his efficacy as a man of business increased tenfold. He threw himself into his work, and the house of Marley and Scrooge grew in stature year by year. Eventually it became clear that it would be to our advantage to put Scrooge's name first in order upon the sign outside our office, as more and more he became the public face of our enterprise. In my absence, he hired a new clerk at below market wages, far less than he could easily have afforded to pay. On the one hand, I wanted to applaud Scrooge for his thrift and savvy. On the other, it was difficult to fully endorse his actions, knowing what the consequences would be. Once, when wandering through the ironworks, I sought out Scrooge's chain and was taken aback. It was monstrous, already nearly double my own and growing at a staggering rate. To have to carry such a chain. You must understand, my concern for Scrooge was not driven by sentiment. I was curious how Scrooge would fare in his life after death, but felt no investment in the question beyond that. He made his own choices, and would have to deal with the consequences, just as I had. I may well have continued in this way of thinking, had I never walked down the alley near the church. But I did, and in so doing changed everything. It was in the sixth year of my death that I first noticed the alleyway across from St. Michael's. In front of the alley, a short, weather-beaten old man stood over a crackling brazier, roasting chestnuts to sell to passers-by. He wore rags and was covered in soot and grime, but his effect was jolly and he sang as he cooked.
Are you going to Scarborough Fair? Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme.
As I approached, he stopped his singing and said,
Hello, Jacob Marley.
I had heard tell of spirits who went unshackled upon the earth with certain responsibilities and authorities. The ghost of unrequited loves, the ghost of birthdays past, the ghost of battles lost, and many others. Until that moment, I had only ever crossed paths with the ghost of all things yet to come, a tastefully indirect name for the black-shrouded figure I saw walking away from me upon my demise. Here, apparently, was another. Do I know you, sir?
Now that I know you, don't I? And I've a proposition.
He introduced himself as the ghost of paths unchosen, and said that he required the services of a man with an expertise in bookkeeping. The ghost's province was a strange one. While other spirits exercised authority over events that happened, he governed those that never did. In most men's lives, there are moments where they are offered a choice between two options that will take their future in different directions. Life continues down one road, though the unchosen path remains, frozen as though in amber where it could be explored by those with the ability to do so. The ghost had been asked to document the various pathways and create a system by which they might be decipherable by the layman. He had no talent for cataloguing and organizing this information, which he knew more instinctively than intellectually, and he wanted my help in the task.
Now, just so as we understand each other, in return for your work, there'll be no tidings of comfort and joy unto you, Jacob Marley. Here is the key to your paddock. Remove your chains and take your place in paradise. But when our business is concluded, at some point in the future, you may come to me and ask for a boon. And if it is in my power, I shall grant it. Are these terms acceptable to you?
I answered in the affirmative. The ghost grinned broadly, displaying a mouthful of dirty and missing teeth.
Right then, let's get to it.
Just down the alley there stood a door leading to a small candlelit office, in which we sat, devising and redevising means of notating the information in such a way that was simple, yet easy to understand. News of my activities spread quickly among the dead of London, a veritable phantom knitting circle of gossip mongers. And though the ghost had made it clear that I would not be freed from my fate, many assumed that this was why I had lent him my services. Drebbel was a particular annoyance, following me through the streets, pestering endlessly, saying,
"I see your game, Jacob Marley. I see your game. What a clever one you are. Your time upon these streets grows short, I'll wager. Bid farewell to Jacob Marley. No doubt he'll be plucked up from amongst the unwashed rest of us forthwith."
I paid them no mind, and after 3 weeks, the ghost and I had devised a system of notation that seemed quite promising. I knew it would not be long before our work was finished. It was around this time that the ghost said how strange he thought it was that I had never inquired about my own path. I replied, saying I was not one for self-reflection, and that I had no interest in second-guessing my past decisions. He smiled, cocked his eyebrow mischievously, as he took a long drag from his pipe.
"Ah, but there are no second guesses to be made when it comes to you, Jacob Marley. For your path is a straight line that diverges not. No matter the decision, in every case, your road ends in the same place. Truly, yours was a destined life, one of the few such I have seen."
I replied that surely the decision to make Scrooge my partner had altered my fate.
"Well, it is true that with Scrooge as your partner, you did become a bit richer than you might have otherwise. Though you lived in the same manner as you would have had he not been, so it's all the same, really. And since you never felt care or friendship for any man or woman, none ever altered your life in any way."
"Are you saying my existence was of no consequence?"
Nah. You may have passed through your life untouched by a fellow man, but you were a great force in the lives of many."
The ghost put his hand on my forearm. Suddenly, we were standing in Fezziwig's offices decades earlier, watching a younger version of myself quietly speak to a much younger Scrooge.
"This is the moment Scrooge made the choice to come and work for you."
I felt a curious sense of discomfort watching myself use Belle to convince Scrooge to work with me, knowing that I had every intention of driving the two of them apart. It wasn't guilt, exactly, but an unease that grew in parallel with the dawning realization of what the ghost was going to show me next.
"Come and see what might have been."
We were still standing in Fezziwig's offices, only the scene had changed. It was Christmas time, and in keeping with the old man's tradition, he had pushed back the desks and turned the room into the scene of his tiresome annual Yuletide party. Music played and people danced, and at the front of the room, in his accustomed place, stood Fezziwig and his wife. Only, no. In Fezziwig's place was Scrooge, round-faced and jolly, laughing and happier than I had seen him in decades. Next to him stood Belle, still recognizable after the passage of years, and all around them were dozens of their smiling children and grandchildren. I saw Scrooge's nephew, Fred, clapping and dancing out on the floor with his wife, and Scrooge's clerk, Bob Cratchit, along with his wife, and a passel of children, most particularly a small boy who danced and ran around the room as if doing so was something he had just discovered. This is what Scrooge had foregone when he became my partner. Family, friends, happiness, and control of Fezziwig's business, which looked to be as prosperous as ever. This is what I took from him. Once again, the ghost put his hand upon my arm, and we were back in his dark office.
"Our business is concluded, Jacob Marley. I thank you for your help. Let me show you out."
I returned to the streets as if nothing had ever happened. Yet that was not quite true. Among my fellow spirits, the conviction that I was soon to lose my chain and go to some more congenial place had taken root so firmly that when it did not happen, most assumed I had done something terrible to lose my reward. I suffered a sort of social ostracism. Here again, Drebbel was a reliable bellwether.
"Oh, the unfairness of life and death! That such an opportunity should be squandered on a dog-hearted canker blossom such as Jacob Marley, while I, the very soul of charity, walk these streets unacknowledged, unfairly consigned to my fate, and ready to offer my... Madam, let me help you with that heavy load, please, I beseech you."
For my part, I was glad to be rid of them. Left on my own, I reflected and came to grim conclusions. I could not deny that I had played Scrooge falsely for my own advantage. This was not satisfactory. In my life and after, people have defamed me, My name has been a hiss and a byword, but my books were always clean. I collected when the bill came due, and did so without mercy. But I always paid my debts. I have lacked in charity, and I have ruined lives. But I have never dealt unjustly. And when I died, I did so knowing that I owed no man for anything. But that was not true. I owed Scrooge.
Tonight's episode of the Junto Presents is brought to you by Dreams in the Witch House, a Lovecraftian rock and roll opera, H.P. Lovecraft's cosmic horror tale from 1933, is presented in 16 epic hard rock tracks. Featuring former KISS guitarist Bruce Kulick and WASP guitarist Douglas Blair Lusick. Available now on the internet webpage witchhouserocks.com.
Winter set in, and the nights grew cold. Shopkeepers began to fill their windows with Christmas decorations, and carolers sang in the streets. At every turn, I was reminded of the Christmas season and the image of the Scrooge who might have been, celebrating with the family he never had. The knowledge that my account was out of balance weighed more and more heavily upon me, until I could bear it no longer. I made my way to the corner across from St. Michael's, where the ghost watched me approach as he roasted his chestnuts.
Jacob Marley!
I have come to collect. He smiled. When I explained what I wanted to the ghost, he laughed ruefully and said,
It's not an easy thing you ask for, Jacob Marley. But I shall see what I can do. Return here tomorrow.
When I came back the next day, I was surprised to find that the ghost's small office had become many times larger. Within it were dozens of different spirits and other beings whose functions and identities I could only guess at. Together, we debated the question of how and whether to proceed at all. A plan was devised, whereby we would attempt to save Scrooge from his impending damnation and restore him some measure of what he lost. It was to begin with me. I would have much preferred to remain behind the scenes of our production, as it were. But the ghost maintained the plan would only work with my involvement. And so it was that upon Scrooge's return to his flat, we teased him with a few unsettling visions. My face upon the knocker of the door, a spectral funereal carriage, to throw him off balance and prime him for what was to come. Finally, it was my time to confront Scrooge directly. I must say I acquitted myself rather well. I had forgotten the ease with which I was able to manipulate him. I had a knack for it in life which had not dulled at all in death. I played my part with the skill of an accomplished actor, and soon I had broken through Scrooge's flinty exterior and put him into a fear for his immortal soul. And then something strange happened. When I told the terrified Scrooge there was a chance that he might escape my fate, he looked up at me from his well of despair and said, "You were always a good friend to me. Thank ye." A cold shiver ran down my spine. My mind went blank, and for a moment I could not speak. Then finally I remembered my text. "Three ghosts." I delivered the balance of my message and withdrew. It had all gone well enough, except for that moment. I walked through the streets with my mind in a stupor and a growing sense of foreboding in my breast. "You were always a good friend to me." I made my way to the alley across from St. Michael's, where I found the ghost roasting chestnuts and singing.
"Seems like that went well. You disagree?"
"It was fine. He called me his friend."
"Well, that's why it had to be you, eh? There's no one else."
"Of course. What a fool I was. It was so obvious. You were always a good friend to me." For the first time, I understood how truly different we were. Scrooge's feelings had not disappeared. They had attached to me. Love fueled Scrooge. It was the core of him. and he could no more abandon it than he could the very lifeblood that flowed through his veins. I took him away from Fezziwig and Bell, and then he lost Fan. In their place, he put me at the center of his heart. He patterned his life after my own, emulated me in every particular, and sought my approval by following in my footsteps. But he made a mistake. He could never be like me, and the attempt would only ruin him, because Scrooge was a normal man made up of passions and emotions. I was an aberration, destined to stand apart from those around me forever, shaped in the form of a man but lacking whatever it is inside that makes one human. I had not just robbed Scrooge of his future. I'd made him love me, and it destroyed him. You were always a good friend to me. The words pierced me to my center. Friend, I thought. I was never a friend, you fool. You should forsake the very day you met me and sought the earth upon which I walk. My debt, it was so much greater than I had imagined. As the ghost sang, all I could do is wait for the hours to pass and look for the breaking of day to find out if our efforts would be rewarded.
Oh, come, Emmanuel.
That Christmas morning, I marveled as Scrooge visited the Cratchit family and his nephew Fred, ready to celebrate the season and make amends for past wrongs. Scrooge became an object of fascination throughout London. The famous hateful miser and moneylender, who overnight turned into a paragon of kindness and generosity. It was as though the old Scrooge had been replaced with the one from the unchosen path. A greater success could not have been possible. And yet, there was still a final account that I was obliged to settle. During the great council in the ghost's office, it was argued that because our intervention was not to be made available to other souls, the usual accommodation for those who might of their own accord put down the burden of their ill deeds should not, in fairness, be made available to Scrooge. Thus, if Scrooge's chain, painstakingly constructed over so many years, was no longer to be used by him, what then was to be done with it? The various parties debated the issue for some time without reaching a conclusion that all deemed satisfactory. That is, until I stepped forward with a suggestion. And so, as Scrooge made himself ready for Christmas dinner with his nephew's family, dressing in a suit of finery he purchased especially for the occasion, I too was being fitted with a new vestment, one I would wear for the rest of eternity. Scrooge's chain. It happened in the middle of the city street, a great spectacle attended by all the damned of London. At first, I could hear Drebbel's voice calling out from the crowd.
Bravo, Jacob Marley, an ingenious device. You'll soon get your reward for this, I'll warrant.
But eventually, even he was silenced by the ghastliness of the scene. When it was finished, I looked like some awful nightmare beast, a mass of knotted iron that allowed barely any range of movement. The other spirits departed one by one, blessedly grateful that my fortunes were not their own until I was alone. As the sun set, it began to snow, and I struggled to advance forward step by agonizing step.
God rest ye merry gentlemen, let nothing you dismay.
I walked toward the alley across from St. Michael's. As I labored to put one foot in front of the other, the ghost turned his gaze toward me. And that was when I saw it. A key hanging on a chain around his neck. Not just a key. A promise of deliverance from my chains and reprieve from my punishment. But did I deserve it? What I had done, I did not out of love or charity, but only to satisfy the pitiless need inside me to fulfill an obligation. Could I rest in paradise, knowing I'd not truly given what was due of every man and woman who there resides? Knowing I still owed. The ghost and I kept our eyes upon each other, a clear path between us. waiting only for me to choose it.
The Son of God by night.
And there I stood, wishing for my heart to be filled with the benevolence and fellow feeling I lacked.
Oh, tidings of comfort and joy.
So that this last score might be settled.
Comfort and joy.
And I could proceed, knowing that within my books the figures are precise, the numbers balance, and all my debts are paid.
Oh, tidings of comfort and joy.
Mr. David Parkin, written by Mr. Robert J. Gibbs, directed by David Parkin and Robert J. Gibbs, and edited by Mr. Timothy Thompson, featuring a performance by Matthew Watterson and the ghost of Dave Labar, with a musical performance by The Peerless Quartet. I am your announcer, James K. Riley, reminding you that the Junto are dedicated to mutual improvement in the lives and business they embody. Who are the Junto? Perhaps, dear listener, the Junto is you.